Hello. Welcome to the Rotten Horror Picture Show, the horror movie podcast where we talk about films off the Rotten Tomatoes 200 Best Movies of All Time list. My name is Clay and I have no voice because I've been screaming from the rooftops how much I love this movie. With me as always is Amanda. How are you doing, Amanda?
I'm doing well. I thought you were going to say it's because you spent the entire drive here stuck behind a diesel-spewing hell truck.
That's just driving in Massachusetts.
That's
true. These are the kind of jokes I'm going to be doing because I sound like a drive time DJ in the morning.
Are you going to prank call the poor census lady next? Is that what's going
to... I need an air horn. I need some sound effects. And I need a porn star to come in and to ask weird questions too. That's what they do, right?
Yeah, yeah. So have you ever like looked at your own tits? Isn't that what they were always saying? Things like that? Where it's just
Yeah, I think that was it.
Yeah.
I mean, what other question would you ask them?
I don't know. How much money do you make in a year?
Well, what's the insurance situation like for the productions and for the actors? Like, I'm assuming they're independent contractors.
Yes.
So I'm assuming they're paying for their own insurance.
Yes.
I don't want to generalize. I feel like a lot of them probably don't have insurance. I apologize to any professional pornographic actors.
I hope they do. They deserve health insurance.
Yeah. They should be. How come they can't unionize?
Oh, I'm sure there are financial interests that will not allow that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway, no porn stars in this movie.
What are you talking about? You mean David Mann isn't a porn star?
Well, his glasses might imply differently, but we are today talking about Duel from 1971. The TV movie so good they shoved it into theaters. Number 108 on our list with an 89% Rotten Tomatoes score and an 84% audience score.
Wow.
If you would like to follow us and help support the show and help pay for my own medical bills.
He clearly needs it. Cue the Sarah McLachlan music.
Yeah, I owe money.
Clay is dying.
I owe money to my HMO and they took my voice. Yeah. Like
like the Little Mermaid.
Yeah. Head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile. You can follow us as we go through sequels this year.
Yes.
Last year we did remakes and reboots. We've done Friday the 13th, the entire series. Halloween, the entire series. Bunch of other shit. And I swear I sound a lot better on those episodes.
On like 99% of those episodes.
99%.
Because I'm sure there has been at least one other where you sound like this.
I mean, there's probably over 100 episodes. Just Patreon, honestly. Is that 12? Yeah. Is that how math works?
not over, maybe not over 100.
Pretty close.
But probably getting
up
there.
So I would say between 7 and 10 episodes where I sound like
shit. Yeah.
I'd say that's a fair fair bet.
One a year, roughly.
But yes, Duel from 1971. Mm-hmm. Had you seen this before?
I had not. I had heard a lot about this because it's kind of apocryphal that Jaws wouldn't have happened without Duel. I have heard a lot about it. I really wanted to see it, and I'm really glad we did.
Yeah, it's the same. This has long been the...
Had you seen it before?
I had not, no.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was just one I never, you know... I don't know. It's just one of those things, like, all these great filmmakers, most of them have movies they made before their, like, first really big one.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, so Duel, it's like, oh, Duel's so good. It's like, I'm sure it is. I don't know. It just. Yeah. what's the other one? Sugarland Express? Is that him? I can't remember if that's him or Martin Scorsese, but it's like, I'm sure that's fine.
Yeah.
But, you know, the really good stuff comes when he makes Jaws.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, this was one I'd been always meaning to see, but I never got around to it.
Yeah.
Everyone I know who saw it said it's great.
You're also very into car violence.
Oh, my God. I love it. I will say, highlight of the film is the 70s car violence, which just does not exist anymore.
No.
For a number of reasons.
Because it's not the 70s anymore.
It's not the 70s anymore. Mm-hmm. Cars are made out of plastic now.
Yeah.
And most of the time they're CGI, so it's not quite as fun.
Yeah.
And people try to be quote unquote safe about it, which takes away all the fun.
Boo.
Anyway, we're going to take a quick break, play the trailer for you, and come back and talk about it.
Thank you. Wait, come on! Come on, back in the bus!
Okay, Duel. The fun part about this is if I raise the volume of my voice, it just like the pitch just screams up. I have no control over it.
Is this like what it was like for you in puberty when your voice was changing?
Baby, my voice always been low.
You could just talk like that for the whole time. That sounded pretty good.
Oh, yeah. Duel from 1971, coming at you, directed by Steven Spielberg, written by Richard Matheson. Richard Matheson, primarily known as a sci-fi short novelist.
Yeah, novelist, short story writer.
Yeah, he wrote The Omega Man, I believe.
Yep.
Which
I Am Legend.
I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. That's right. That's what I meant. Yep. I Am Legend. He also wrote, I think he wrote a bunch of Star Trek episodes, the original Star Trek.
Probably. I feel like he was one of those guys who just like, once you know his name and you watch anything from like the 60s, 70s, like late 50s, 60s, 70s, he's everywhere all over like horror and sci-fi.
Yeah, he's like, I feel like him and Harlan Ellison pop up a lot around this time.
Yep.
Because they were doing, Harlan Ellison definitely doing Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Richard Matheson, I think, was doing... I think he was doing The Twilight Zone.
I was just going to ask you, because I have the same like,
also,
itch in the back of my head
like
that he was doing that.
Night Gallery, I think he did some of those. So all these, they're around.
Yeah.
It's always funny seeing their names, though, because I think of a lot of those authors as just authors.
Yes.
So it's like you're watching something, it's like Ray Bradbury.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't realize how entwined different parts of their career really became with television and film and the Hollywood machines.
Yeah. Starring Dennis Weaver, Jacqueline Scott, Lou Frizzell, and one big-ass truck. Amanda.
Yes.
What happens in Duel?
David Mann, a mild-mannered electronics salesman, is driving on a two-lane highway when he encounters an old oil tanker driven by an unseen driver who seems to enjoy annoying him with dangerous antics on the road. Unable to escape the demonic big rig, David finds himself in a dangerous game of cat and mouse with the monstrous truck. When the pursuit escalates to deadly levels, David must summon his inner warrior and turn the tables on his tormentor.
Sure.
Yeah, AI is. That's what AI told me this movie is about. So,
like how much it undersells the truck.
And how much it oversells David, to be frank. Well, Clay, some things you'll find in Duel include... immaculately 70s vibes from the cars to the clothes to the fonts.
The color saturation alone on this is like intense, to the point where the blue sky was like it almost looked like it was artificially put in,
because
it was like breaking up around the mountain lines,
and the car looks like almost grotesquely red. Like, I felt like I'd never seen the color cherry red before.
Yeah, and one of the things I was reading was, so this started as a TV movie, and then they expanded it to make it a feature film to put in theaters in Europe specifically.
Oh.
When they did the 4K restoration of it, they didn't do the 4K, like, actually 4K restoration. They just used, for the TV version, they just AI upscaled it.
Oh, okay.
However, the version we watched is the full film. So it's a long way around for me to say, I don't know what's going on.
You don't know what the hell happened to it.
Yeah.
All right. Well.
Looks great, though.
Yeah, it does. It does. You'll also find the painful reality of AM radio.
Yes.
Something that people don't really do anymore.
No, it's kind of, it's mostly just for psychopaths now.
Yeah,
And my dad.
Shit kickers.
Gotta love them.
We haven't had some shit kickers in a while, I feel like.
Yeah, it's been a while for shit kickers.
It's been a bit. Copious inner monologue.
Yeah, that's where you can really feel the novelist, I think.
And the TV movie of it all.
Yeah, because I was reading originally, they weren't going to do that inner monologue.
Mm-hmm.
But like, when Matheson was adapting it, he like couldn't figure out how to get that stuff across visually, and so they just thought it'd be easier to put the monologue in.
Yeah,
and it, excuse me, it almost works. I think it doesn't not work.
Yeah,
but it doesn't stand out because they did that stuff all the time back then.
Yeah, I wish it. I just when I added this to our Things You'll Find list, the word copious was really the operative word of like, there's just too much of it.
Yeah,
you could have done less.
Yeah,
could have done less. You'll also find Dr. Stringfellow's Rejuvenator Medicine Show.
Yeah, in the background. Mm-hmm. That is actually a prop from an episode of Night Gallery, which I assumed was one that Spielberg directed, but it is not. I don't know. He just liked it.
You will find it along with the Snake-O-Rama, including yard boxes, yard snakes, yard coyote, yard spider, and yard iguana.
Yeah. The desert's an interesting place.
To keep things in boxes in your yard.
Yeah, I don't ever want to go there.
To the desert or to the Snake-O-Rama?
I guess Snake-O-Rama primarily.
What?
Desert's fine.
You don't want to go to the Snake-O-Rama?
Not if the snakes get out.
Why not?
Fine, you end up with a spider on your leg crawling up your
pants. I mean, I just feed it to the snake.
That's not how it works. They're friends there.
I don't know. They're in separate boxes.
They don't live in the same house. They're friends.
They live in separate boxes. They have separate houses.
Those are called rooms.
They are not connected. They're freestanding.
They live in a community, gated community.
You can hate your neighbors.
That's true.
Lord knows I do. Anyway, you'll also find, quote, a weird place for a telephone booth.
Yeah. That's one of those bits where it feels like, it's like, we got to put this here so we can do this gag.
Yeah. We also need him to get to a phone. Yeah. So let's just put the telephone booth next to the snake boxes in the Snake-O-Rama.
Yeah. I don't think I would have noticed it unless he said it.
Yeah. He just says it. And one of my favorite bits that follows that is when the truck has started destroying the Snake-O-Rama and he's yelling at the woman who works there, call the police. And she goes, with what? And last but not least, you will find Chekhov's radiator hose.
Yeah, that was pretty slyly done, I think. Like, I kind of forgot about the radiator hose thing.
They revisit it like one too many times for me to say it was fully subtly done, but I still liked it. I still appreciated that it was sort of like this symbol of, he thought everyone was trying to like rip him off and get one over on him, but yeah, they genuinely were just like, no, sir, you need a new radiator hose.
Yeah. Well, to be fair, I don't blame him, because I don't know if it's just from all of the media I've taken in over my life, but when I take my car into the shop,
just ready to be scammed.
Yes. Same reason I didn't go to the dentist for a long time. I'm like, they're just trying to sell me new teeth. And I don't
need
new
everybody
teeth.
Does talk about how the dentist is trying to upsell you.
And some of them are.
Some of them are.
Not all of them, though.
That's true.
I have a good one.
Hi, Clay's dentist.
Hi, Dr. Todd. I don't know if she's seen this. She might not have been listening to this one. Anyway, that does bring us to a good place to start where...
Mm.
So...
What's your favorite type of snake? Oh, is that... Sorry, is that not where you wanted to start?
No, I guess I don't really have one. I like those, like, red and yellow colored ones. I don't know what they're called.
The really pale yellow ones?
No, it's like mostly red. Maybe it's just a rattlesnake. I don't know.
You might just like a rattlesnake.
Yeah, those
That's
are fun.
Fair. Yeah.
This is a movie by Steven Spielberg.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot at all argue with the quality of the filmmaking.
Yes.
It's very, very good.
Yeah.
He's doing stuff in this. This was a television movie.
It is crazy to remember that when you're watching this.
This was in 1971. Mm-hmm. Not that it's the same content, but watch Salem's Lot 10 years later, which is also a television movie.
Yep.
And just, it's like two completely different things.
Yeah.
Not that Salem's Lot is bad, but it feels like TV.
Yes.
This does not feel like TV.
Yeah. And not that this is perfect, but just the quality of what is being done. Everything in this movie felt very intentionally chosen.
Oh, yeah.
Like, obviously all the shots and all of that stuff. But even, like, I don't know, just, like, where they had them driving and sort of the background stuff that I know a lot of it's real.
Oh, yeah.
But it just felt very purposeful, and like the look of David Mann, like his outfit, mm-hmm. like felt very on, like everything was very intentional.
Yeah. Apparently, I guess they didn't do storyboards, but they actually created a gigantic map of everywhere they were going to go. And everywhere the camera, and it took up all four walls of the hotel room that Spielberg stayed in.
That's amazing.
However, the thing that doesn't quite work for me with this movie is that as much as I love what they're doing in it, at least for the first half, I just cannot connect with it because I fucking hate that main character. Like, I know he is supposed to be a schlub. Who's like kind of a pushover. But the thing that was getting me, so this happens to me a lot, specifically when I watch Bob's Burgers. I love Bob's Burgers. Every now and then they'll have an episode that I just can't, like, just starts to make me mad because whatever the central conflict is something that could be resolved with like one conversation.
Sure.
And now obviously the guy driving the truck in this is not interested in talking.
Yes.
But I feel like there's any number of things he could have done to try and defuse this situation.
Would you say that there were several off ramps?
Yes, I would. Mm. Very well done.
Thank you.
English major?
How did you know?
It shows.
Thank you.
Yeah. but like, it's just, the second half of the movie, I started getting into it a bit more because he started doing stuff that I was like, well, why don't you go fucking talk to the guy?
Yeah.
And he tries to do that, but he can't do that.
Yeah. And you're like, why don't you just pull over for a while and wait? And then he does do that.
Yeah. Joe, go get lunch for an hour or something.
Yeah. He tries to call the cops.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's when it really starts to work. But I agree. First half, he's just, cause like the transition of that character is, I guess, probably supposed to be from non-confrontational schlub into Mad Max the Road Warrior.
I don't know. I don't know if it's quite that simple, at least not in my reading of the movie. I feel like you're not supposed to like him at the beginning, and I think it definitely has a lot to do with the non-confrontational schlub aspect of it. But he also has a certain level of like he kind of seems like he thinks he's better than others in a lot of ways. And he thinks he's a
badass until somebody pushes him.
Yes.
And it's like,
yes. And he thinks he kind of knows everything and he has it all under control, and he's very dismissive and sort of condescending to a lot of the characters that he interacts with in that first half of the movie. And I think that is very intentional of like, everybody knows somebody like this who talks a big game or acts like, well, you know, what I'm doing is very important and I can't be interrupted, so I don't know what you want me to do about that. You'll just have to wait. And then the second somebody with more actual power or authority comes in, they immediately kind of become subservient and step back and like, oh, I would never want to offend. I mean, please. Right. You first. Right. Right after you. Yeah. And he's that kind of character.
Yeah.
And I do think that the movie is pushing him the whole time to get underneath all of that, like to sort of find something within him where he is able to endure and actually like stand up for himself in a concrete way, not just in a kind of blustery way.
Yeah, I think it's that that condescending element that makes it really hard to root for this guy.
Yeah.
And like I'll agree that the ending of the movie is really interesting because very smartly Spielberg knows the old Roger Corman rule, which is once you kill the monster, you roll the credits.
Yeah.
But one of the things that I find so effective about the way it ends in that respect is that the ending, I don't know if I'd call it like a triumphant ending, because it ends with him just like sitting on a cliff.
Yeah.
Just like with this look on his face like, what the fuck just happened?
Yeah.
And it's so it doesn't totally feel like he had some breakthrough or anything.
Mm.
You know, and I guess maybe that's where I was not giving the movie enough credit because this guy is not necessarily what you'd call a hero.
Right.
He's put into the position where he needs to triumph over this antagonistic force.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like the wimpy guy learns how to be a superhero or anything, you know?
Sure.
It is kind of like guy who's a shithead.
Yeah.
Kind of ends up getting himself into a situation that he is not prepared for, doesn't know how to handle it.
Yep.
Figures out a way out, but then it's like, I don't know if I don't think he learns anything.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a good question.
Who knows? Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't.
Yeah. I think, so I took a lot when we watched this, I thought that the conversation he has early on in the movie with his wife over the phone is really integral to this film and really important, actually, even though I'm sure if you're just like casually watching this on TV, it was just sort of like, oh, it's another example of how he's kind of a shithead.
You would think so. And I also thought like, oh, okay, that sets the whole thing up. That's not in the TV version.
That's crazy.
That's part of the stuff that he shot as extra footage to expand it out.
That's really wild to me.
Yeah.
Because I feel like the situation his wife describes eventually over the phone, because the way it happens is, you know, he's sort of had his first little duel with the truck and he stopped at the gas station and he's gotten change and gone in to make a phone call to call his wife. And he starts the conversation with this very sort of lame apology. And it's very like, oh, well, you know, I know we didn't talk this morning because you were still asleep, but I just wanted to apologize, you know, for last night. And she was like, please don't. Like, let's not. Can we not get back into this? I'd prefer we just move on. Let's not do this. And he sort of insists. And it comes out that she got upset with him because they were at a party. And another man at the party was like assaulting her in front of him.
She says like he was basically she's obviously hyperbolizing a bit, but
yes.
She says he was trying to rape me at the party.
Yeah, in front of everyone at the party.
Yeah.
And you just stood there. And he tries to...
What kind of party was it?
Clearly not that kind if she was surprised by the treatment.
It's true.
But you know, she clearly wanted him to stick up for her and come to her defense.
Yeah.
And he obviously did not. And I think it's really an interesting bit of character character interaction to put in there, because then later on in the movie, he becomes the one begging people to kind of come to his defense.
Yeah.
And they do not.
Yeah.
They also don't want the confrontation, except now he's on the receiving end of it instead of the bystander side of it.
Yeah.
And I don't know. I think this movie would feel really different if you watch the version where that's not included.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Because having that in there makes it feel, you know, I don't want to say that it makes him deserve what the truck driver does to him.
No.
But it does set up a more of a character arc of him being put in this position that he'd never had to be in before, that he'd allowed other people to go through without helping them.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, well, first of all, to be fair to him, the pigs and blankets at that party are so good. And they go so fast. I mean, they were coming out with a new tray as the stuff with his wife was happening.
Yeah,
and
he really
know.
Wanted a hot, fresh pig in a blanket.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't?
Yeah.
Anyway. I forgot what I was going to say. The joke is too important. What were we talking about?
David Mann.
So I think the thing that either makes it more difficult to connect with for me or actually makes it more of a complex character, I don't really know where I fall in this. Excuse me. Is the fact that I read a couple people say, like different filmmakers say, the thing that they, or even I think Spielberg said, the thing that he connected with this was he knows what it's like to be bullied. So it's like, okay, the truck is bullying and, you know, finally you got to stand up to your bully.
Sure.
But it's still that condescending nature of the character that makes it hard to, like, get into this idea of guy, you know, this George McFly story.
Yeah, yeah.
Where he finally punches Biff.
Yes. Yeah, you're right. Rather than at the end it feeling like finally he's vanquished the bully that was after him for no reason at all, it's like, oh no, not that the truck driver was acting in a commensurate level of aggression, but it all kicks off with him being an impatient driver, David Mann being an impatient driver and insisting on passing this truck.
Yeah.
And then, like, continuing the back and forth, right? Like, and he is such a kind of just smarmy guy in a lot of scenes that initially, you can sort of look at the truck driver's behavior and be like, I kind of get it. It's only once it escalates out of the realm of reality and into this, like, hyper reality version of I'm going to try and fucking kill you with this truck.
Well, you know, what's interesting about that, the conversation with his wife, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you take that out, I think this plays much more like an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Because it definitely has that vibe where it's, you know, guy who thinks he understands everything, pulls some shitty move, and then ends up angering the universe to the point where it's, you know, he's going to get a comeuppance for it.
Yes. Yeah.
But adding that scene with the wife in makes it so much more complicated.
Yeah.
And so much more interesting, but I still don't know where to come down. I sound like a broken record, but, like, the movie itself is so good.
Yes.
It's just that guy.
But also, I think I do think that the setting up the sort of gender conflict or, like, gendered interpretation of all of this I think it's really there in the movie. Like, I think the movie supports that interpretation because there's not just the conversation with the wife. There's also the sort of, I don't know whether to call it a prank call or whatever the radio DJ does to the woman who works for the census office.
Is that different from where the guy talks about how he can play meat?
That's different.
Okay.
Yes. There's a long exchange in the background when David is driving early in the movie where a radio DJ has decided he's going to call the number on his American census form.
Mm-hmm.
And he is talking to this woman who sounds pretty young. And he has this elaborate story that he's come up with about how he wants to mark that he's head of the household on the census, but he's really not because he's a stay-at-home father who raises the children while his wife works.
Right.
And there's this very 60s, 70s undertone to it where he's, again, it's a fake story, but he's pretending like he's embarrassed by this. And he wants to put that he's head of the household to get back at her because he actually hates his wife.
Yeah.
And then he starts saying to the census woman, like, are you married? And she's like, no. And he's like, well, when you get married, like, don't become like my wife. Like, you know, when you date women, they're so nice. And then you get married and they become aggressive.
Too true.
And it's so, it goes on for a really long time.
Yeah.
And so I think that there is definitely in this movie some sort of some commentary, some thoughts on, like, the sort of stereotypical, like, middle manager, suburban dad at that time in America, feeling like, well, I'm head of household. You know, I have very important salesman business to do.
Yeah.
And it's like you're kind of performing this type of manliness that doesn't have a lot behind it.
Yeah.
It's sort of just propped up by, like, props, you know, by the suit and the tie and the very pristine car and the suburban house with your wife at home taking care of the children.
Yeah.
And I think the challenge in this movie is that David has to find something beyond that to lean on.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the reasons that I get so stuck on this is because there is, and I don't mean this as a negative, there is nothing else to this movie than two guys in two cars trying to kill each other.
Yep.
And I mean that in the best way possible.
Yeah, yeah.
Because, like, I don't think that you need any more information about anybody.
Yeah.
Like, you don't even see the fucking truck driver.
Yeah, you see, like, his arm and his boots.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But David, like, I don't know. I don't know if I'm going to, I don't need to know where he's coming from. I don't need to know what his job is.
Nope.
Like, I think his attitude and his visual presentation do all the work you need.
Yep.
You know, the way he interacts with people, I think that goes a long way. You just don't need all that extra stuff.
Yeah. See, this is also how I feel about the inner monologue, though.
Okay.
Where I also feel like a lot of the stuff that the inner monologue says, I don't think it needs to say it quite as much.
Sure.
Like, yeah. I understand it. I understand using it, especially in the Chucky's lunch counter or whatever.
Yeah. That building is still there, apparently.
That building is wild looking. I think it's really fascinating looking. I understand having needing to lean on the voiceover inner monologue while he's having this sort of moment of deep paranoia at the lunch place, and he's trying to figure out which of these many men in blue jeans and brown boots is driving the truck that's been terrorizing him at this point for like 38 minutes. And he's going,
it's just like William Friedkin's Cruising, except with a lot less fisting.
Jesus Christ.
As far as I know, I've heard things happen at truck stops. You know? Sorry, but, I didn't mean
no,
to
no,
knock.
No. just, you know, you threw me off with the word fisting. Something I don't really want to think about. But yeah, like I understand why in that sequence there's a lot of inner monologue.
Yeah.
Because it's trying to emphasize that he is spiraling. He's going through these like scenarios. He's imagining going up to these different guys and how he would approach it and to confront them and like how he would approach it to maybe diffuse the situation a little bit. And they all, you know, kind of don't pan out the way he wants. And then when he finally does quote unquote confront the truck driver, he's like a sweaty shaking mess and seems like a maniac, and the guy immediately gets offended and like beats the crap out of him on
the pool
table.
That's another thing, like it's really hard for me to get behind this guy when he slaps a sandwich out of that guy's hands. I would fucking murder him too. I'd get in my car and I'd team up with the truck.
Yes. Hate that guy wearing the tie. I hate that guy wearing the tie.
Also, he orders a cheese sandwich.
Yeah, Swiss cheese on rye, RYE.
Ugh. I mean, I love me some cheese, but two pieces of bread with just dry cheese on it—that
is something I would have eaten when I was like 7 years old.
I used to do cheese with tomatoes and mayonnaise.
Okay. Mm. Yeah.
Great.
That sounds. That's especially got a good tomato.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That sandwich he had was garbage, though.
Yeah. I think they probably made it garbage on purpose. You come in there and you're only going to order a cheese sandwich.
Yeah.
What's the tip on that bill going to be for her? 5 cents?
I mean, let's be serious. Nothing on that menu is probably more than $5 in 1971.
$5 is pushing it. I think $2.50.
Yeah. But yeah, I like when he gets in that guy's face and then slaps the sandwich out of his hands, I was like, motherfucker, throw this guy through the fucking window.
Right? Like, it they make it hard to relate to him. Not relate to him, I don't know. Yeah, they make it hard to empathize. They make it hard to sort of have sympathy for him for solidly the first half of the movie, because he's either being a little bit of a smug jerk or just making dumb choices.
Yeah.
And then it's not until much later on when things get much more dire that he starts, even when he panics in the second half of the movie, it's an understandable panic.
Right.
Like his life has been put so at risk at that point that, and it's clearly been going on kind of all day, that you understand like, he's just under so much stress at this point that he's kind of collapsing in on himself.
Yeah.
I can have more sympathy for that than just being weirdly rude to the gas station attendant.
Yes.
Yeah.
I do really like that diner sequence, though.
Mm.
That's really fun.
Yeah.
Where you know, he doesn't know if one of the guys in there, he's only seen the boots.
Yep.
And they're all wearing boots.
Yep. And they're all wearing brown boots. Yes.
And I think that's one of the really great things about this movie is all of the different ways that they kind of fake you out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't see anytime like he looks out and he doesn't see the truck and then he sees the truck or mm-hmm. the thing with the what looks like a police car and turns out to
yes,
be
the pest control car or something.
That's really good. Mm-hmm. It's really clever with the way that they do that. Yeah. To the point where I was 100% sure when he pulls off the road and falls asleep next to the train.
Mm-hmm.
I thought when the train finished going by that the truck was just going to be on the other side of the track.
I thought so too, actually. Yep.
But yeah, they do all that stuff really, really well.
Yeah.
And then even when it gets down to just the two of them at the end, when they're going up the mountain, that's really done really well too. Because, you know, he's finally hit an area where the truck is... is at a disadvantage.
Yes.
But that's when the hose goes.
Yep.
And, you know, the scariest part about this for me was when I was watching him doing 80 in neutral down a mountain road.
That does sound pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, there's... Once he starts trying to address the situation like a human is when I was kind of getting to like the one thing he didn't do that I was like, I feel like this probably should have just done this is he tries to walk up to the truck, but that doesn't work.
Yes.
But then the guy starts waving him on and he drives by it.
Yeah.
Stop next to the truck, look into the window and go, what the fuck?
But I think I understand why he doesn't. Because when they're both in the when they're both in their vehicles and the vehicles are moving, that's when the truck driver is clearly like, now I'm going to fuck you up.
Yeah.
Like when he's not until the end, when we get to the end and he's at the Snake-O-Rama, the truck driver is like, yeah, sure, I'll hit you now. You don't have to be in a car now.
Perfect example.
Stop you from calling the cops.
Perfect example of the cone of narrative vision. Mm. He tries to call the cops, but then the guy smashes the thing.
Yep.
Cops, you know, nobody calls the cops.
Yeah, he kind of successfully does.
There are not even road cops in this movie.
Yeah, no.
I feel like there should have been at least. Well, see, because then.
But I think the implication is they are on some small, like, county highway. You know, they're not on the major highways, they're not on the major roads, and also it's cutting through shit kicker land, and there's no cops just sitting out waiting to give tickets
even. Well, I feel like a lot of other movies might just have, I mean, because that's something like if you're putting things on a board, what are some complications? They run into a police officer.
Yes.
But and I do think the one thing that kind of goes against this is the Snake-O-Rama sequence. There was a certain, I didn't seriously think this, but there was a certain amount of the movie where I was thinking, it's fairly possible that this truck doesn't exist. Because they never, their interactions never cross over with anybody else.
Yeah, and people keep asking him, like, what happened? Yeah. What happened out there? Like, you just hit that fence. And it's like, nobody, even the bus driver.
Right. Yeah.
When he has, why didn't you ask that truck for help? And he goes, what truck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then he's like, oh, I must have missed him. But like, and I think that's why if you bring a cop into the situation.
Right.
You're blowing right through that idea.
Yep.
And I'm not saying that the idea was that the truck doesn't exist. I'm saying like it is. The action is so contained to just these two people.
Right. And anybody else who sort of incidentally ends up on the periphery of this action, they are not seeing what the main character is seeing.
Right. Except for the snake lady.
Yes. Yeah. Poor snake lady.
Yeah. Well, who's she going to tell? She doesn't have a phone. Her phone's just got blown up. She's not going to call
anybody.
She's
got destroyed. I do want to go back quickly to... when David, a couple different times, at least twice, tries to, on foot, approach the truck.
Yeah.
And the truck keeps a very on-purpose distance. I think when that starts happening is when it starts really feeling like, okay. There, no matter how you as the viewer feel about David as a character, once he starts trying to just, you know, walk up to the truck, It's this huge truck. He's just a guy. This is like the least threatening way to try to resolve this, is to just be like, I'm just in person coming up. I'm not trying to start a race or a fight or anything. And the truck driver won't allow it. That's when it's like, oh, okay. There's nothing he could do.
Yeah.
There's nothing. At that point, you start to realize there's nothing David could do to defuse this situation. That whoever or whatever this guy driving this truck is has decided this is going to end badly.
Yeah.
No matter what.
And also, like, at that point in the movie, I think once he denies talking to him, the reason that he doesn't stop in his car and, you know, try to, is because I think at that point, once he gets back in his car, it's like, this is the final battle.
Yeah.
You know, this is how it's going to go down.
Yeah.
One of us is, you know, this is Thunderdome.
Yes. Yeah. And I think there's also a level of, like, when you're in this movie, it's sort of like when you're in your car, you are your car.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Where it's sort of like, even though the truck is...
I think you just wrote a Deep Purple song.
Yeah, probably. Even though the truck is so much bigger than the car, it's sort of like when David is in the car, he's accepting the challenge on equal ground.
Yeah.
In a way where it's like, now we're both armored and we will fight. Whereas when he's not in the car, he's not playing the game.
Right.
And
right.
the driver wants him to play the game.
Right. Filmmaking, incredible.
Yes.
There's a shot in this that I feel like you're never going to see in another television, at least probably not until the last 15 years, where I think he's riding, the camera is riding slightly behind David's car, and then it like kind of pulls out to the side and turns. So it's like looking at the guy driving behind David, and then the camera kind of pans out, and this is all while they're moving down the highway.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's an incredible shot.
Yeah.
And not only, I mean, everything in this movie is amazing. The truck work is amazing. The car stuff. David's actually a pretty good driver.
Yeah.
The way he kind of zips around some stuff.
Yeah.
But like, as you said before, it does get me in my car violence. I don't know what the word is, but sweet spot.
Yes.
That car he's driving took some pretty good bangs.
I love that fact that he is in this very pristine, like, again, not to try and like overcomplicate this movie, but I do think that David is the type of character to whom appearances matter greatly.
Sure.
Like, he's in his, he's driving around all day and he's still wearing a fucking tie and dress shoes.
Yeah.
And he's clearly got like his dumb haircut, but it's clearly like a choice of a haircut.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
But I do think he thinks he looks better than he does.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. No. I absolutely think he thinks he looks great, like very professional and put together, very serious man. But I think like appearances matter a lot to him. And so that's why, at the beginning of the movie, that car is so pristine.
Yeah.
It's so perfect. It's obviously like waxed and shined within an inch of its life.
Mm-hmm.
It's the brightest red you could ever conceive of. And it's just like a very, very perfect looking car. And then as the movie goes on, it starts to take more and more damage.
Yeah.
And by the end, it's literally a wreck at the bottom of the cliff with the truck. And I love that. I love that it's sort of like this unstoppable force has just come in to like fully fuck up his life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's visually amazing. The thing that really actually, before I knew that they had done extra stuff, the thing that kind of knocked me out right off the bat was the opening, which is essentially 5 minutes of silence and just first person footage of a car driving from the city to the country.
Yep.
With the only audio is like the radio.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, this was a TV movie in 1971 doing a TV movie that started with 5 minutes of silence is insane.
Yeah.
But even knowing that stuff was added later, so the first person stuff was added later, but once he shows up properly, that's where the original movie starts.
Okay.
But even there, he's still driving it.
Yeah.
He's not talking to anybody.
Yeah, it is just the radio and him sort of scoffing or laughing at the radio and the man who plays meat.
And there's so little dialogue in this movie, full stop.
Mm-hmm. Which is, I'm sure, another reason why they leaned quite a bit on the inner monologue voiceover, right. Because otherwise there would be so little dialogue in this movie.
I just remembered the reason that originally, before they did the inner monologue, Richard Matheson originally was going to add his wife in the car with him. So she was going to be a second character. So he would have somebody to talk to.
Yeah.
But then he decided against it and just did the mod. But that's another thing where it's like, I think you could do all of that inner monologue stuff visually with no dialogue. Like the scene in the cafe probably works even better without any monologue.
Mm.
But again, that's a whole scene in 1971 on TV with no dialogue.
Yes.
That I just don't think people would stand for it. They'd like be like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
If they're even paying attention to it, a sweaty guy
sitting in a booth in a diner ordering a weird cheese sandwich and then sitting there in mostly silence for about 7 minutes until he slaps another sandwich out of a man's hand.
Yeah. Like, you're probably folding your laundry or something while you're watching this, going like,
wait, did the TV cut out? What happened?
And then you look up and the guy's just like, bleh.
I mean, some of my favorite movies are like that. The guy's just in the woods.
That's true.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's so much stuff in this that is, I feel like it feels stupid to say this, but like, even at this point, you can tell that Spielberg is not your normal director. Like, he knows, he goes for it.
Yep.
He knows how to get it.
Yep.
And he's very good.
Yeah. Yeah, it really does look great. And the kind of car battles, I don't even really want to call them chases, because it's not like always high speed. Sometimes it is actually very slow speed. But like those sort of confrontations between the two vehicles, like, they look so good and they're shot so well that every time I thought to myself, this is a TV movie from 1971. Like, how did he even do that? And I think it really, it is one of those things where, even if I didn't know it was Spielberg who directed it, if I had just watched this cold, I would have been like, wait a minute, who is this guy?
Yeah.
Like, who made this? Because this does not feel like a TV movie.
No, I mean, it doesn't feel out of place in as a theatrical film. Like, just, again, I hate to crap on Salem's Lot, but it's like, that movie looks like shit. Mm-hmm. You know? I'm sorry, it does. It
has its moments.
It's obviously, it has more things than this movie does.
More stuff. Yeah.
That, you know, probably the budget was stretched a little more thin.
Sure.
Than just.
It's also like 4 times longer.
That's true. But it's just like, anytime I see that movie, it's like, this looks like TV in the 70s.
Yeah. No, it does, which is too bad. It's sort of like, would have been nice to see a version of that looked like a little better. But
the vampire, he looks fine, but he also kind of looks like shit. And especially now, I think this is the big, this is where Duel pulls away, is that you watch these movies now, Salem's Lot in 4K looks like shit. Like, every seam, every TV production value.
Sure.
Like, when this originally was on, I'm sure it looked amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You can get away with a lot more when you're watching on a tiny TV from the 70s.
Yeah, with fuzzy picture. Yeah.
But you take Duel, you blow Duel up to 4K, it still looks amazing.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, all credit to Spielberg and his team.
Yeah, and there's such interesting camera work.
Yeah.
In this, and the idea that it is in, you know, I think in a lot of ways we're very desensitized to driving scenes in movies and TV now, where, like you mentioned, it is so easy to just CGI things. And
it's so depressing.
It is. But this is just actually happening in cars outside.
Yeah.
Like, this is a real car on a road.
Yeah.
Like, and
this is a scene where a guy peels out and smashes into a fence.
Yes. And it just, I mean, not only does the fact that it's a real car make it look that much better, it also makes it that much more impressive that they get the shots that they get and the whole way it's set up and the way the action flows.
I know I've almost definitely mentioned this before. Have I ever shown you that clip from the Italian movie?
Yes.
I have. Okay.
You have. I know exactly what you're talking about.
It's the most incredible thing I've ever seen.
It is like it was designed in a lab for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Watch the movie. I think it's on the Arrow video player. Get the free trial. Watch the movie Highway Racers, and you will know what I'm talking about when you see it.
Yes.
Anyway.
Catnip for Clay.
Yeah. However, the one my one biggest problem with this movie.
I know what it is, yep.
Is that we spend the whole movie looking at the huge ass of this truck.
Yes.
With flammable written on it. Like he bought sweatpants from Forever 21 in the 90s. And then
I had those ones, the ones that said flammable across the ass.
Those were hot.
Yeah.
And then when the truck goes off, he hits the car bursts into flames.
Yes.
And I'm like, here we go. I've been waiting for this. I've been waiting to get to the fireworks factory this whole movie.
A romantic song starts playing in your head.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Everything goes off the cliff. Meatloaf starts playing in my head.
Yeah.
And then they smash. Oh, incredible. This is amazing. Boom, boom. The camera work here is incredible. I've never seen a car go off a cliff like this before. It hits the ground.
Uh-huh.
That's when it blows. Nope.
Nope.
They don't blow the truck up.
Nope. They just let it get real dusty. Yep.
Sign of an amateur. One big mistake he made in the movie was not blowing the truck up.
Yeah.
Because.
Or scrape the word flammable off the back.
That's true. It was a conscious choice.
Oh.
Yes.
I thought it was a budgetary thing.
No,
I swear
he was
to God,
being a little too arty for his own good. Because it says network executives wanted the truck to explode after it went off the cliff. However, Steven Spielberg argued against this. He wanted to show the truck slowly dying so audiences could get a sense of payback since the truck had spent the entire film torturing the driver.
I
had read somewhere else that he also he thought of the truck as like a monster.
Okay.
So he wanted the monster to die. He's overthinking it. You put flammable on the back of the truck.
Yeah.
Anton Chekhov's rolling in his grave.
Yes. Yeah.
The truck doesn't blow up.
Clearly he learned his lesson, though, because then in Jaws, the shark does blow up.
I was thinking that.
Everyone was so mad at him for not blowing the truck up that he was like, fine, we'll blow up a shark instead.
I was also reading that he was like, well, that would be the obvious thing to do, to blow the truck up. And then I'm like, the next movie you blow
he's
up.
Like, blow it up.
To be fair, blowing up the shark, not the obvious move.
Not the obvious move. Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, how do you feel about the ending, the end sequence up through the final smash em up?
You know, I don't have the same deep affection for car explosions that you do. I enjoy a good car explosion, don't get me wrong. But I'm not a connoisseur in the way that you are a connoisseur.
I think I like the smashing more than the exploding.
But you were sad that there's not an explosion.
Yes, I was.
Yes.
I was sad.
Yes. Which and it makes sense. I agree. Having flammable written across it the whole time. But it I don't know if I needed an explosion. But it does feel weirdly like a letdown at the end. And I wonder if that's kind of on purpose.
That's kind of what I was saying with the ending. It's like
it's
not really a triumphant ending. Like the exploding truck.
Yeah.
Like the shark and Jaws exploding is such an exclamation point on the horror that brought them to this point.
Yes.
And the catharsis of finally getting rid of the shark.
Yeah.
This is really like that.
Yeah, it's sort of fascinating to watch it because, you know, David manages to survive this hellish confrontation and he manages to bait the truck and get it to go over the cliff. And he runs up to the cliff's edge and he's sort of doing this like dorky like skip and a jump. And like he clearly kind of wants to like whoop and holler and celebrate, but then he just sort of like it all just like drains out of him.
Yeah.
And I think in a lot of ways that's more realistic.
Yeah.
Like at this point he is probably so exhausted and so deep in disbelief and the adrenaline crash is immediately hitting him. But as the end of a movie, it does feel kind of strange. It feels kind of anticlimactic and I don't know. It's I think you were right too, where you said, you know, Spielberg knows the lesson of like the when the monster dies, you roll the credits.
Yeah.
I think this is the spot where you end the movie, right?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
But I don't know. It feels a little bit like it is missing something. And I don't know if it's as simple as it should have exploded or if there's something more intangible that's just kind of not hitting for me.
Yeah.
At the very end.
Yeah. Because my first thought, like I felt like in that moment I was inside David's head. Excuse me. Because once he sat down and I knew the movie was ending, my first thought was, where the hell is he?
Yeah.
How the hell is he going to get home?
Yeah.
Like that kind of is the vibe he has.
Yes.
Is not quite, you know, I just slayed the dragon.
Fuck you, truck. I win. Yeah. It's not it's that. Like
that car was my ride.
Right. So, yes. Yeah.
So yeah, it is a really weird, a weird way to end it.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because like, you know, myself and these network executives complaining about the truck not exploding.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like the answer to that is, did you not see everything that happens at the end?
Yeah.
The way it hits the car, the car catches on fire.
Yeah.
And then when they do go over the cliff, it's incredible.
Yes.
Like they've got like six cameras up that are all catching every single smash and boom, 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 boom.
I do also, I think I really like the sort of silence after it's all landed.
Yeah.
Like where the camera does go down sort of into the carcass of the truck and you get that little fan still whirring, but you see the blood kind of dripping down that kind of connotes that the driver is dead.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of that's really great, but there is just this weird empty feeling at the end.
Yeah.
And I don't know if there could be a different way to end it.
I mean, it just sort of
feels a little like this is how it would have to end.
I mean, I guess if you really wanted to dig into it philosophically, as, you know, we love to do, there is sort of a thing where it's like this, the action of this movie is about this battle, ultimately this like battle of machismo.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it's over,
it's
kind of a moment where you're kind of like, what was this for?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, like why couldn't I just talk to this guy?
Yeah.
You know, what if we gained here?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. No, I think that is an interesting way to look at it, especially taking the title of the movie into account.
Yeah.
Where duels were a thing and they were kind of just about the outward trappings of honor.
Yeah.
They were rarely about anything of actual substance. It was sort of just like, you've offended me and I cannot let that stand, and therefore we will draw pistols at dawn.
Yeah.
And then one of us is going to die because you ignored me when you came into the tavern, I guess.
Yeah.
It is that sort of like, we're going to go through all of this and somebody is going to have to pay an ultimate price. And then big shrug, time to move on. The winner of the duel wins nothing.
Right.
Yeah.
It's it kind of reminds me of Ridley Scott's first movie. It's called The Duelists.
Oh.
Which is basically what you're talking about, but it's about two guys who get into a duel for a dumb reason.
Mm-hmm.
And they can never finish the fight for various external reasons.
Mm.
So their duel lasts like 50 years. Every time they cross paths, they have to go out and duel like again.
Set up to duel, yeah.
Yeah, and then like someone shows up and like, come on, we got to go back to the front lines or something.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's like, you know, you get them in, they're both soldiers in like the, I think it's in the Napoleonic era. It's somewhere in there.
Sure.
Might be a little before that. It starts with a sword fight, then that gets interrupted, and then they end up, 5 years later crossing paths in like the frozen steppes of Russia. And they're like, come on, let's go tomorrow. We gotta
finish this.
Yeah. And then that doesn't work. And then and then finally, like literally 30 years later, they end up crossing paths again. Mm-hmm. And, it's really good. Much like this, it's a great first movie.
Yeah.
But yeah, there is that movie also, you get this feeling where it's like, what is the, in that one, there is one of the other characters who's like what are we, why are we doing this?
Yeah, yeah. Why, like, do you keep doing this? Yeah. Why are you insisting we have to do this?
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think it is, what, there's a, I forget what movie it is, mm-hmm. but there's a movie that has a great line where, like, at the end of it, it's like a heist movie or a crime movie, and all these people get killed, and then somebody says something to the effect of, all this violence over just a little bit of money.
Yeah.
You know, and it's that kind of looking at these things where it's like, what are you actually getting out of any of this?
Yeah.
It's very entertaining for us to watch.
Sure.
But for the characters,
yeah.
What are they gaining?
Yeah. I think the difference, I mean, obviously the difference in this movie is that, like we were saying earlier, even when David tries to end the duel, like, even when he wants to concede or just opt out, even when he is in a position where he's recognizing no one's gonna gain anything from this. Nothing good is gonna come of this.
Right.
I don't want to do it anymore. The unseen truck driver refuses to let him quit.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, kind of takes this in even a different direction than those other movies that are focusing, whether it's on duels specifically or the sort of, like, we went through all of this for some frivolous thing. In this, it's like, he didn't have a choice a point.
Yeah.
He was in this whether he wanted to be or not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really good.
Yeah.
I think it's,
I love that you never see the driver.
Yeah. Like, excellent.
I think that's great.
Yeah. This was a TV movie. They shot extra stuff. Most notably the beginning, and there's more cars. The one, as I was reading this, I was like, oh, that makes sense. And then one scene in particular popped into my head where I was like, this has to be an extra or reshoot.
Mm.
And I was right. It's the school bus scene.
Mm.
Excuse me. Because that was a scene where I was like, this feels a little added on.
Yeah, that scene is, you know, we sort of briefly alluded to it earlier, but it is a really strange scene in there. And I think it sort of functions in a similar way as the other big added on scene with the phone call with the wife, where it's telling you something about David's character. Like, he's, it's still early enough in the confrontation between him and the truck where he still is holding on to some of that, like, kind of condescending attitude.
Yep.
And he's very, he doesn't want to be bothered with the bus, the broken down bus full of kids. He's very annoyed when these kids sit on the hood of his car.
Mm-hmm.
When he tries to push the bus out of the ditch that it's stuck in or whatever, and the kids are all, like, clumped in the back of the bus windows and they're making faces at him and they're yelling at him and they're kind of heckling him. He clearly is getting, like, riled up by it, which I think is really revealing about what kind of person he is, that he's a grown man and he's really letting these, like, 9-year-old kids get to him.
Yeah. I was also thinking, I was on his side in that scene because I was like, his car can't push that fucking bus.
Yes.
This guy's insane.
Yeah. No, I agreed. I agreed with that premise, but the fact that he's so, like, ugh, helping children.
Well, there is nothing,
like, great.
As you get older, you do realize there's nothing more devastating than a bunch of children making fun of you. So I understand that.
I think it's teens. I think the teens are worse.
I think it's
because little kids like that, you can turn them to your side pretty quickly.
Yeah, I suppose.
You know, when they're that little, they don't, they're just kind of doing it because it's fun and their friends are doing it and whatever.
Yeah.
The teens are the truly
devastating. I saw a bunch of teens outside the other day.
Hmm.
Just yelling at each other.
Yep.
Like, I don't know what was going on.
Yeah.
I couldn't tell if they were friends. I couldn't tell if they were fighting.
Why not?
No punches were thrown. It was just like 4 or 5 teenagers.
Yeah.
Just yelling at each other.
Hormones, man.
And then, like, one person went into a nearby house and was like, my grandmother's in here. And then they were like, okay. And they dispersed.
Yeah. That's how it works.
The last thing I want to talk about was the music,
which
was done by a guy named Billy Goldenberg, who had worked with Spielberg on Columbo and Night Gallery.
Mm.
And I thought it was funny. He gets a fairly prominent credit in the opening credits for music by.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was a little funny because there's not a lot of music in this either.
Yeah.
And it doesn't come in until deep into the movie.
Yeah. And when it does, it's kind of... there's not really, like, a clear theme.
Well, there is, but they stole it straight up from Psycho.
Yeah, like, sure.
The music is pretty explicitly stolen from Psycho.
Yeah, but what I meant is like the moments, at least that I really remember hearing music come in, it never quite feels the same.
Yeah, it's always a
yeah. It's like a play on the Psycho music, obviously, but like each time I hear it, it's like, oh well, that's kind of a different take on it, and that's yet another take on it, huh? Like, there's no clear like, yes, this is what we play when the truck is really menacing.
Yeah,
there's like a couple different things they play when the truck is menacing, and they never reuse them.
Right. Yeah.
So it's sort of weird.
John Williams would have knocked the shit out of this movie.
Yeah.
Home run.
Yeah.
My favorite music cue is obviously when they use the Psycho shower sting.
Yeah.
And they use it at my favorite part of the movie, which is like, it's so absurd that I have to assume they did it because they knew it was so silly, which is he pulls up to a red light and somehow the truck sneaks up on him.
Yeah, yeah.
He's just like looking out and then he looks into his mirror. He's like, wow. This giant,
it's right behind him.
20 ton truck is right behind
it. It has appeared silently, a la like you know, Michael Myers or whatever.
I was assuming there was going to be more of that where it's oh, I guess I lost him, and then all of a sudden it was going to be behind him again.
Yeah.
But it's all fairly, you know, quote unquote realistic.
Yeah, except for that one part.
Yeah. But do you have any final thoughts? This is number 108 on our list. How do you feel about the placement? Would you call this a horror movie?
See, I stumble over that.
Yeah.
I really do, because it's definitely a thriller. There's a lot of tension and suspense, and you know, if you let yourself get really swept up in this movie, a lot of like, oh God, what is he gonna do? And how is he gonna make it out? And what's he gonna do? But there's not a lot of like scares.
Yeah.
You know, there's not a lot of dread in this movie. It's very like tension and suspense, and then like the scary part of it is thinking trying to put yourself in David's position and imagining if something like this did happen to you. Like, I don't know, if you're a person who drives a car with any regularity especially in like a busier metro area, you've probably shared a road with somebody who's driving like a fucking maniac before.
Yeah.
And depending on how bad it is, it can be really terrifying to be on the road with someone driving blatantly dangerously who does not care.
Oh yeah.
So I sort of get it from a realistic perspective. Like if I put myself in that position, like, yeah, that's scary. That's a genuinely scary thing to happen in real life. But as a movie, I don't know. It's just, this movie doesn't frighten me.
Yeah.
You know? So I don't know. What do you think?
I don't think I mean, it's I wouldn't say it's really a horror movie.
Yeah.
I think it comes close only in that the way that the truck is presented is like has a sprinkling of supernatural.
Sure.
And I don't mean like it's, you know, possessed or something. It's just like it's unreal just enough.
Yeah.
That I think you could slot it in there.
Sure.
But yeah, generally I would say it's more like a thriller.
Yeah.
You know, a buddy road comedy.
Well, like what's that, shit, you're going to yell at me. What's the movie where it's like, they can't let the bus drop below.
The bus that couldn't slow down?
Yeah, pretty much.
Speed?
Thank you. But like, I wouldn't call Speed a horror movie.
No, no.
And it shares, you know, a lot of DNA.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's sort of this, like, is closer to like Fury Road.
Sure, than, you know,
than I mean, even Jaws, I would say, is more of a horror movie than this.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's interesting because these are, I would say, this is and Jaws are not entirely dissimilar from each other.
Yeah, I think maybe for me, part of it is because this movie is so pared down.
Yeah.
Where it is just, you know, a man, a van, a plan. Panama. Like, do you know what I mean? Like it doesn't have a whole heck of a lot of the genre trappings.
And
so when you're watching it, it does feel very much just like this man driving this car.
Yeah, it's not like Wrong Turn when you find out.
Right.
trucks being driven by mutated
right.
ill people or something. Yeah, so I think I would drop it off the list.
I think I would too.
It's really good, but I just...
It's really good, but it also feels a little redundant to have it on there when you have Jaws on there, which yeah. I would argue is like the more refined version of this type of story and the more horror-leaning version of this type of story.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Yeah.
All right, I think that's going to do it for Duel and my ability to speak for the next week.
Yep.
I apologize again to... Hope it wasn't, yeah. I would like to thank Robert F. Kennedy for hosting this episode for me. I'm going to hit the randomizer button. Beep, boop, beep, boop, boop, beep, boop. And next time, we will be doing number 56, which is Guillermo del Toro's The Devil's Backbone.
Oh, good, because I've been wanting to watch this.
I haven't seen this, I think I watched it once in college, which was 20 years ago. Longer than that, actually, probably 23 years ago. God, oh my God.
This is why you sound like this.
I just picked the wrong grail, I think, and it turned into dust. If you'd like to help support the show, head over to patreon.com/thepenskyfile and follow us as we get into sequels. January was Gremlins 2.
Mm-hmm.
February is Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, which should be out sometime next week. Which will be fun because I'm looking forward to doing a Hammer movie again. We haven't done Hammer in a while, so it should be a good time.
Cool.
But thank you guys for listening. Thank you, Amanda.
Thank you, the Ghost of Clay.
And we'll see you next time.
Bye, everyone.